This is a CBC podcast.
Absolutely no room to maneuver whatsoever. They would get us into a trap, gain time, make a deal with somebody else, and whatever trick they've got in their hat, as they always do. No room to maneuver. What we ask or nothing.
The bloc leader says, my way or the highway, straight to an election campaign. And the Liberals, well, they don't sound too convinced about spending the billions in new seniors benefits that the bloc is asking for. Here's Health Minister Mark Holland.
You have to use a filter of what's logical, what makes sense for the country, not what's going to please a political party in any particular moment.
I'm Catherine Cullen, and this week on The House, we'll try to sort out whether the bloc would rather have a deal or an election. Plus, as the one-year anniversary of October 7th approaches, a look at the divide in how Canadian politicians see the war between Israel and Hamas, and a look ahead at the path out of a crisis that has killed tens of thousands. Also, the federal Liberals lifted Newfoundland and Labrador's three-decade-old cod moratorium, but a briefing note suggests the move was politically motivated and could be bad for the fish. The fishermen aren't impressed either. We'll talk to the Liberals, the Conservatives, and the people who go out on the water to bring in the cod. But first, the government stuck between the bloc and a hard place. The House is now in session.
If the Liberals do not give us what we demand on behalf of 4 million Canadians and 1 million Quebecers, and supply management, we will start discussing with opposition in order to have this government fall.
Bloc leader Yves-François Blanchet is hurtling towards a showdown with the Liberals, and the government might be hanging in the balance. The Bloc has two clear demands. They want more money for a portion of the senior population, as well as trade protections for dairy and poultry. This week, the Liberals had a chance to support the bill for seniors. The government declined, so the Bloc is turning up the heat. They say the Liberals have days, at most a week, to show progress on their demands, or else. So, does the Bloc really want a deal, or would they prefer an election? For some insight, I'm joined in studio by Daniel Thibault. He's the host of the Radio-Canada weekly politics program, Les coulisses de pouvoir, behind the scenes of power. I prefer the corridors of power as a translation. Dan, thank you so much. Welcome to the House.
Good to see you. So
why is the Bloc staking everything on these two demands, seniors and supply management?
Yeah, it's a good question, because those two topics are very, very connected with a large portion of the voters that the Bloc is after in Quebec. Why trying to force the government to protect supply management system for dairy and poultry? Because the Blocs have a large footprint in rural areas in Quebec. And so you see a lot of farmers, a lot of Quebecers benefiting from the supply management system. So that resonates with their voters. Why the pension? Because the pension issue for 65 to 74 years old in Quebec is also a large portion of the Bloc's voters, if you will, outside of large metropolitan area. I was looking up the way they vote. Those people vote, and they vote very, very aggressively. In 2021, that was the largest voter turnout in the federal election. The people from 65 to 74 years old. That's quite an efficient group of voters for the Bloc, and they know that it gives them a path to keeping their seats right now and possibly growing up a little bit.
So, these are things that do prompt us to think about policy issues, supply management, old age security, but really what you're telling us is there's some pretty pure politics here when it comes to motivating their voter base.
Absolutely, absolutely. And those particular issue and the way they're putting pressure on the government works in both ways for the Bloc. Because if they win something, they go back to their voters and say, see, we forced the government to do something for you. If they don't win, they go back to their voters and see, we tried and the Liberals just didn't want to play with us. And so it's a win-win for François Blanchet. He knows it.
And Blanchet is really leaning in even more this week on the pressure on the government, suggesting that there's really just a few days left to iron this out in order to meet what he had already set as an October 29th deadline. So in some ways, sort of moving up the deadline he set. He's really trying to raise the stakes.
I'm not certain at all that this bill will pass. Not certain at all. But I said we will give this government one chance to do something right for many Quebecers and many Canadians. If they do not seize the opportunity, then the most probable scenario will go forward. We will start discussing in order to have an election and compose a new parliament.
Why do you think they've tried to basically speed things up this weekend?
Because there's no need for him to slow down. The line in the sand was so carved in that there was no way for him to back down. In fact, I was looking at it and I was talking about it with people from other parties, and no one could see any possibilities of a compromise. Now, how do you fulfill those demands without being very specifically within the frame that the Bloc has built in front of the government? And so by pushing it or bringing it a little forward this week, demanding that the royal recommendation was adopted before the next break, it's just one step further. But Mr. Blanchet doesn't need to slow down the pace here.
I just want to help folks along here. Royal recommendation, that is the money to go along with the seniors bill. We're talking about $16 billion over 5 years, so more than $3 billion a year. It's interesting because we did hear from a few cabinet ministers this week who were saying, like, it doesn't make any sense. The argument they're making for this money for seniors, it doesn't make any sense. So it makes it hard for them to turn around and then say, oh, actually, you know what, in order to keep the government standing.
There's still some wiggle room, but it's very, very, very limited. And in some cases, publicly, a lot of private conversation. The government doesn't see why it would make sense to spend that $3 billion on the first year that this measure would cost. There's a lot of economists who've come out and said, you know, maybe that particular group doesn't need that money that bad. Maybe it should be directed to specifically to seniors who need it. And maybe the option that François Blanchet's putting forward is a little too broad for the needs out there right now. And
it also flies in the face of what the Liberals have been saying about generational fairness during their last budget and younger people.
And they brought that back in during the debate this week, generational fairness. And that's a big cue on which way the government intends to go over the next few days.
Now, ultimately, yes, this is about potential benefits for seniors and it's about dairy farmers, but this is also about whether or not we end up in an election. Given that the Bloc won that surprising Montreal by-election, LaSalle, Émard Verdun, they've got some wind in their sails. How much do you think they do or don't want a trip to the polls right now?
I think they're, I don't know if they do, 100%, but they're willing to go and they're ready to go. They have the money, they have the candidates, they have the infrastructure. It's a much simpler election to run when you're the Bloc Québécois, right? Because you're campaigning in one province, so it's not that much. You don't need to rent a plane. You need a bus. It's a tour that's fairly simple to organize. The money is there. And so in that case, in that particular situation, the Bloc is probably at the same level of readiness than the Conservatives might be. And so out of the four parties in the House of Commons, I'd say that the Bloc and the Conservatives are both very interested, very willing to go now. Not so much from the Liberals and the NDP side. And that's where it might get interesting over the next few days.
Now, actually, I want to touch on the Liberals a bit more here because some, notably Minister for Seniors, Minister for Labour, Stephen McKinnon, suggesting that the Bloc actually want a Conservative government because, according to McKinnon, the Bloc believe that that would lead to the winning conditions for sovereignty. Walk me through what is going on in that argument, Dan, and if it makes any sense.
I know it's something that's been talked about in some political circles, sovereign in Quebec, here in Ottawa. I've heard some observers take a look at it that way. Some believe that because of the way Pierre Poilievre does politics and because of the way his politics are received in Quebec, and you'll notice that he's very popular across the country, but not so much in Quebec. And a lot of voters in Quebec will actually vote for the Bloc because they don't like either the Liberals or the Conservatives. They're leaders. And so the theory is, well, maybe a Conservative government would do politics in such a way that they would reignite the sovereignist flame in some voters in Quebec who've put that in the back burner in the past few years and stop thinking about it. Could it be brought back by a stronger tone in politics that Poilievre was expected to bring? That's certainly a theory. And so from that particular lens, the Bloc could see the arrival of a majority government with Pierre Poilievre at its head as a good way to bring back sovereignty on the front burner in Quebec.
So multifaceted, fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for this, Dan.
Pleasure being here.
Daniel Thibault is the host of Radio-Canada's Les Coulisses du Pouvoir. Monday marks 1 year since Hamas's horrific attack on Israel. That day led to an all-out war between Israel and Hamas. Tens of thousands of people have been killed, and the conflict is spreading into more and more of the Middle East. In a moment, we'll talk to experts closely watching the region about the path forward. But first, we want to take a closer look at the political debate in Canada. Starkly different points of view were laid bare this week in the House of Commons. On Tuesday, the parties held an emergency debate on the crisis in Lebanon and Israel. The debate began with the NDP's foreign affairs critic, Heather McPherson, who was very pointed about where she and her party stand.
There is no military solution to this crisis. War crimes must not beget war crimes. If we continue down this path, there is nothing but death. For 1 year, we have witnessed the horrifying violence of Netanyahu's genocide in Gaza, which followed the terrible Hamas terrorist attack on Israel on October 7th. For 1 year, our party has appealed to the Canadian government to do the hard work to secure a ceasefire, to implement a real arms embargo, to get Palestinians to safety, to return the hostages, to de-escalate, to save the lives of so many, including children and vulnerable people, especially Palestinians in Gaza who are bearing the cost of political inaction and the betrayal of international law.
On the opposite side of the debate are the Conservatives. Foreign affairs critic Michael Chong put forward his argument in favor of Israel.
Mr. Speaker, all states have a responsibility to defend their citizens and to defend their territory. The state of Israel is no different. Israel is at war. This is a legal war under international humanitarian law. The war the state of Israel is conducting against Hamas, against Hezbollah, and against the Islamic Republic of Iran under international humanitarian law is a justifiable war. It is a justifiable war against two terrorist groups and a state that sponsors terrorism. Canada did the same thing during the Second World War. We defended our citizens and our territories against a hostile threat. And the state of Israel has the right to do the same.
Opposing points of view are also playing out inside the Liberal Party. Some Liberal MPs were quick to call for a ceasefire, while others have emphasized Israel's right to defend itself. Here's Liberal MP Iqra Khalid.
What we have watched in the year since is a disproportionate, brutal, and inhumane slaughter of innocent lives. It is not a targeted strike, but collective punishment for an entire culture, for the actions of specific extremist people. And we have seen Netanyahu's regime have made it clear that they do not see any difference between a terrorist aggressor and an innocent child playing in the street. There is no difference between the terrorist and the innocent, and that all must be eliminated. This is how they spoke of Palestine, and now how they speak of Lebanon in the same way. We do not tolerate this type of behavior from any nation, and we must hold our friends to that same standard.
Contrast that with Khalid's colleague, Minister of Addictions and Mental Health, Yara Sachs.
It is not enough to say that the violence has to stop and to say that there needs to be a ceasefire. Because if, at the end of this ceasefire and the cessation of violence, Hamas and Hezbollah are still armed, then we've gotten us no closer to ending this cycle of violence. This is why a two-state solution is imperative. This is why recognizing terrorist organizations for what they are is critical to understanding that in a multilateral world, these are not militias or state actors. These are terrorist organizations who do not play by the rules of what we recognize as a rules-based order. They put civilians at risk. The cost they exact on civilian populations for their own agenda is what we need to recognize and fight against.
While the war has put people in the same party and certainly in the House of Commons at odds, there was a moment Tuesday that reflected respect even in the midst of those differences. Here once again is the NDP's Heather McPherson speaking about Minister Sachs.
I just want to express my sadness and my sympathy with the member. I know that she has family that are in Israel, and I know what she has suffered over the last number of months has been horrific. I also want to acknowledge that Jewish people across this country, Palestinian people across this country, Muslims, Arabs have faced such incredible racism and such discrimination. Even within this house, we have seen this member be a victim of discrimination and of horrific hate speech, in my opinion. I'd like her, I just wanted to give my sympathy and to express my support with her.
I want to thank the member for her comments. You know, Mr. Chair, what is so special about this place is that we talk, we debate, we don't always agree, and sometimes we don't always agree quite strongly, but at the same time, our jobs as parliamentarians is to build bridges in communities, to see each other in their pain, and to help in that process of healing and making our country stronger. So I want to thank the member for her comments.
To better understand the situation in the Middle East and what can be done to prevent a wider regional war, I'm joined by two people who know the Middle East well. Dennis Horak is a retired diplomat. He was Canada's ambassador to Saudi Arabia and the head of Canada's mission in Iran until 2012, when the embassy was closed. And Thomas Junot is a former analyst for the Department of National Defense, now a professor at the University of Ottawa. I spoke with them on Friday. Welcome to the House.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me.
A year ago, when Hamas attacked Israel, killing more than 1,000 people and taking these hostages, did you think that this is where we were going to find ourselves now? Thomas Junot, I'll start with you.
Well, I think obviously nobody could have predicted exactly how this would unfold, but I think it was pretty clear to most experts, the people who've been watching the region for a long time, that while this was one phase in a long-standing, decades-long conflict, a particularly brutal phase, that it was not going to be resolved shortly. It was clear that Israel would hit Hamas hard, and once that would happen, it was clear that the risks of regional spillover were very serious, and 1 year later, that's what we're seeing.
Dennis, a year later, what are you thinking?
Yeah, I think that's right. We've seen these various wars of limited duration many, many times over the decades. But I think it was the unprecedented nature of what happened on October the 7th and then followed up by the shelling from Lebanon October the 8th signaled that this was going to be different and this was going to take longer and the response by Israel was going to be harsher, and then that would open the door for, as Thomas said, much more regional interventions.
I do want to talk about the wider implications in the region that we are seeing play out right now. And then I want to come back to Israel and Gaza. Thomas, Iran's decision to fire about 200 missiles at Israel, knowing that this could lead to a bigger confrontation that could perhaps even draw in the United States. Then on Friday, we had Ayatollah Ali Khamenei warning of more strikes to come. Help us understand why Iran has escalated like this, taken this risk.
Well, Iran was really facing a difficult dilemma because on the one hand, Iran realized, and I think it's the correct perception, that if it did not reply, it would be viewed as weak. It would be sending a signal of weakness, a signal of weakness to Israel, and Israel would and has been exploiting that, notably by hitting Hezbollah even harder, but also sending a signal of weakness to its own allies, think Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis in Yemen, and sending them a signal that Iran might not have their back as much as they thought Iran would, and also sending a signal of weakness to its own population. And as a dictatorship, as a brutal dictatorship, who survives at least in good part thanks to repression, that's not a signal you want to send. So Iran perceived that it had to reply. But at the same time, Iran's leaders, and they're very rational about this, they understand that the more the military situation escalates, the weaker it is, the more vulnerable it is. Because in conventional military terms, in conventional military power, Israel, because of American support in part, is far more powerful than Iran is. And Iran absolutely knows this. So Iran does not want an escalation that it knows it will lose. So it was really in this difficult situation of trying to find a balance of perceiving it had to respond, but perceiving it also has to avoid an escalation.
And Dennis, if we look forward, giving the perspective that Tamar just shared with us, what are you watching for from Iran?
Well, I think we're going to have to see what happens. I think the next step is Israel and how they respond. And are we going to get something like we had in April, where there was a relatively limited response, and then everybody drew a line under and said, okay, let's go forward? I don't think that's likely. It's possible. Or do we get a much harsher response, in which case Iran needs to respond again with a show of force and demonstrate that they're not deterred, they're not cowed, and they will respond. And we also saw today in the speech by Khamenei, where partly given in Arabic, interestingly enough, as I understand, was a message to the broader region over the, certainly with their allies, but also the broader region, that they're the ones standing up to Israel while the rest of the world, the rest of the region is letting things pass. And that's a message, I think, that they want to resonate across the region, to partly build up their own prestige, as Tomas said, to reassure allies, proxies in Yemen, in Lebanon, in Iraq, Syria, that they're not cowed by Israel, they're not afraid of Israel. And where that leads, I think, is really open to speculation and is really anyone's guess.
I'd like to spend a bit more time reflecting on Israel's point of view, the Israeli government's point of view in all of this. Tama, earlier in the week, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned that Iran would pay for this attack. We know that also, though, Netanyahu has seen some support from Israelis for the attack on Hezbollah. So help us understand what the government's calculation is at this moment.
Netanyahu's calculus, as is always the case, has to factor in multiple considerations: domestic politics, ideology, relations with allies, security perceptions, and so on. In this case, what I think matters and what makes me lean towards predicting, always being cautious with predictions, but predicting a fairly harsh Israeli retaliation, not like the more surgical one that we saw in April, is domestically, politically, Netanyahu is under a lot of pressure to respond and to respond in a serious way. He leads a coalition that includes far-right elements, and these elements are constantly putting pressure on him that if he agrees to a ceasefire in Gaza or in Lebanon, or doesn't respond in a hard way against Iran, that they might leave the coalition. And obviously, as a politician, as any democratic politician, he doesn't want to lose power. But on top of that political dimension, there's a more abstract cultural or political culture dimension at play here, that in Israel, in large part because, as Dennis briefly mentioned, the very deep trauma, the scars, which are still open, of October 7th, an absolutely brutal terrorist attack, 1,200 Israelis dead, the worst day in the history of the Jewish people since World War II, and so on. The mood has shifted for a lot of Israelis, that the approach of the past of managing the conflict, of trying to contain the conflict with Hezbollah, with Hamas and others, that doesn't work anymore, that's what took Israel on the road to October 7th, so that there's a need now to, quote unquote, take care of the problem once for all with Hezbollah, but maybe also with Iran. So that, I think, is pushing Israel towards in a direction where the response will be much more serious.
Dennis Horak, Tamajuno is talking about a likely strong response from Israel. And yet what so many people want to know is, what could an off-ramp be at this moment in these tensions between Iran and Israel?
That's the big question. I'd just like to come back to something, Tomas, just to add on to what Tomas said. Partly what's also driving Israel is the need to reestablish a deterrence, that they can't just respond weakly, and to make Iran feel the pain. Iran has been able to do what they do through proxies. They're the ones who feel the pain. And I think Israel wants to make Iran feel the pain for a change. And that perhaps reinforces the deterrence. Where the off-ramp is a difficult question. I think it begins with Lebanon. I think it begins at some point with UN Security Council Resolution 1701, which brings Hezbollah above, north of the Litani River, away from the border, that Israel is able to get their people in the north. If some sort of diplomatic magic can be fastened to make that happen, I think that is perhaps the road we have to get to, at least in the initial stage. whether we get there, how we get there, what Israel's military plans are for southern Lebanon now and continuing strikes into Beirut, parts of Beirut, trying to target presumably Hezbollah leadership. I mean, that all has to die down, if you will. That all has to end, really, before we can get to that next stage. And that's perhaps part of the diplomatic route that we head to.
Yeah, Tomasz, you know, I mean, Denis Horak used that phrase, diplomatic magic. He's talking about the United Nations, but we think just this week, Antonio Guterres being declared persona non grata by Israel. The diplomacy is very much strained now. What do you think is the best off-ramp available?
Well, I think the word magic is the right word to use, in the sense that at this point, I'm not optimistic that there is a diplomatic off-ramp. The fact, as you mentioned, that Israel banned the Secretary General of the UN from its territory is reflective of the reality of how diplomatic processes now, which could be in an ideal world, maybe in a magical world, those off-ramps that would take us away from conflict and towards peace. These diplomatic processes right now are extraordinarily shaky. There is no strong foundation on which to build. And we could spend hours and hours trying to lay blame on different sides. But it's the reality that we're on now. And because of that, it is essential for the U.S. and also for regional mediators like Egypt and Qatar to continue trying to look for that diplomatic magic. But I think we're not close from a point where we can seriously see that off-ramp, whatever shape it eventually takes, in operation.
And Gaza is almost barely getting a mention these days in the midst of this broader conflict. In closing, Denis Horak, I'd like to ask you, as we look for this path to peace, is there anything that Canada can do?
That's a big question. I mean, just coming back to one point, I don't think there's a role for the UN in this diplomatic magic. It has to be the key players. It has to be the United States, which is preoccupied, obviously, with its own internal electoral process. Other players in the region, perhaps Saudi Arabia, could step up and play a bigger role. In terms of Canada, We really don't have a role. Our role traditionally in the Middle East has been to stand by and ready to be helpful if needed. And the classic example being after the Oslo Accords between Israel and Palestine, Canada was named the gavel holder of the Refugee Working Group, which was an important role. But that illustrates the sort of thing that we can do, that we can stand by ready to help as the big powers decide we're needed. Our influence in the region is virtually nil. We haven't established the kinds of relationships that we need to do, particularly over the last 10 years. And we're just not key players there. Our key role there, A, is to make sure our citizens are safe. B, is to stand ready to support whatever the mediators, the powers, those involved, whatever they may need, stand ready to help out when we can.
I think the way Denis framed it is exactly right. Our contribution is to be willing to help our allies. And that's our main interest. I mean, our main interest in the Middle East is to be and to be perceived as a reliable and capable ally when necessary, with specific contributions, when the U.S. asks in particular, and perhaps when European allies to a lesser degree also ask. But these contributions will be limited because diplomatically, militarily, and so on, what we can actually bring to the table materially is very limited.
Thank you both for your insights today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
University of Ottawa's Tomasz Junot and former Canadian diplomat Denis Horak. And a programming note, we did want to speak to Canada's foreign affairs minister this week about developments in the Middle East. Melanie Joly's office said she was not available. We want you to know that we have been trying to bring you that conversation for some time. Since October 7th of last year, by our count, we have requested an interview with Melanie Joly 23 times, without success. Lots more coming up on the House podcast. We're out on the water, fishing for cod, but hearing a lot about politics. Stay with us. I'm Catherine Cullen. You're listening to The House, making politics make sense. A new episode drops every Saturday. You can find news and interviews on our website, cbc.ca/thehouse. This summer, the federal government lifted the cod moratorium 32 years after it was first imposed. But when the news came, it wasn't greeted with relief and celebration by some in Newfoundland and Labrador.
The Russians are coming back. The Portuguese are coming back. The Spaniards are coming back to fish on our grounds, to tow across those grounds. That's the lifeblood of Newfoundland. It will not stand. We are asking for meetings with the Prime Minister to get this thing fixed.
As members of the Fish, Food and Allied Workers Union made clear in July, some harvesters didn't want to see the cod fishery opened up to international vessels once again. CBC's Caroline Hillier has been speaking to several fishermen in Newfoundland who say politics is still getting in the way of them making a living.
I've been down around those wharves ever since I was a little boy. It just gets in your blood.
Carl Hederson has fished off this wharf in Noddy Bay on the tip of Newfoundland's northern peninsula for nearly 50 years.
This stage here was my father's, and the one over there was my grandfather's.
This summer, the talk on the wharf is about what the federal government described as the, quote, historic return of the commercial northern cod fishery, but what people here call politics.
We haven't been fishing none yet. Here it is now, soon be the last July, and, well, the moratorium was called. Before the moratorium, it was the same thing. We were scraping by, trying to get through the summer and basically try to see if you get enough for EI claim. And we've been scraping ever since they shut her down, and we're still doing it. We haven't
got none. Ending the moratorium was presented by the federal Liberals as a good news story. But in practical terms, the fishermen say it doesn't really change much here. The cod fishery actually already reopened in 2006 for small boats that fish close to shore. So these fish harvesters have been catching small quantities of cod for years. They did get a small bump in their allowable quota, but what's more significant is now offshore draggers, big industrial vessels that fish year-round and have factory freezers on board, can fish cod in Newfoundland and Labrador waters once again.
Another fisherman there, huh? Wait.
Those international and Canadian draggers that scrape the bottom of the ocean for cod are a big point of contention here. Most fishermen on this wharf blame those boats for depleting the cod stocks.
We still never got any. It was just all giveaway. That seems like what the thing in Canada is to do now is to give things away to to other countries or whatever. So, but like I said, it made them look good, I guess, on the news that the moratorium lifted, but it never made no difference to the fishermen there. If anything, made it worse. So.
Been waiting all this time to build it up and then put the same boats back in it that destroyed it in the first place. So, you know, somebody is not thinking. I guess everybody is going to get the cod, not only the few inshore fishermen now. Everybody's going to get it, so.
Well, I think it's all politics, of course. That's what it's all about. And it's going to be one of the worst summers I ever made. I never made many good ones.
How long have you been fishing?
Well, I'm 61 year old. I've been out in boat ever since I was big enough to get aboard a boat. I haven't missed a year of fishing.
We're going to get aboard here now, and you careful there now. Yeah, might be a little bit slippery. Where
these days, Hederson has downsized to a 25-foot boat.
Okay, you're all cool, ready to go?
Yeah.
Last month, Radio Canada reported that lifting the moratorium ignored the concerns of Department of Fisheries and Oceans staff. They feared opening up the fishery would put cod at risk of decline again. But political advisors within the minister's office argued reopening the commercial fishery would be, quote, politically a victory.
What?
There's a lot of fish coming out for a short time. I wasn't expecting this.
Carl Hederson says while there's more fish in the sea, it's not enough to sustain a livelihood.
My son would love to be fishing, but for what I got here, he sees the misery I go through with all the rest of the small boat fishermen here, and he just can't do it. And for me, I mean, my license that to pass it down to him, he knows it's no good. He don't want to be doing what I'm doing, but if there was something in it where he could make some money.
Hederson believes the fishery will die with his generation, but he has a solution, lobster.
You know, lobster's only become abundant now all around Newfoundland in the last few years. They were having a big scrape before that.
Lobsters have been filling up coves and coastlines here in recent years. Warming waters are sending more of them north.
I mean the lobster is doubling every year to what they got. Fellows have never, ever taught the catch rates be like they are in this little area. You know, I said a little area, but it's a big area compared to other areas.
But of the 25 or so fish harvesters here, there are only five with lobster licenses.
When this stuff is being fished, the people that's fishing that are doing quite well. And the fellows that don't have that stuff just got to sit idle by and watch them with nothing to fish. I mean,
Hedderson thinks that instead of focusing on announcing the end of the moratorium, the government should be helping with new economic opportunities.
We put in a proposal. We didn't ask for the same amount of pots that all the rest of the other five fishermen got here.
He's been taking politicians out on the water, telling anyone that'll listen about the opportunities these lobsters bring. He thought they were getting close to action on the issue, but when an announcement for new lobster permits came, it wasn't for them.
What's going on? The lobsters are plentiful, and now the minister just issued some new license there in the Quebec region. So, I can't see why they can't do it for hush, you know.
In May, the federal Minister of Fisheries and Oceans announced 25 new exploratory permits for lobster in Quebec's North Shore, exactly what Hedderson and others had been fighting for in Newfoundland.
Nobody hears us because I guess we're not complaining enough. We're just trusting to other people to help us out and do something for us. So what we're doing now, most fellows are just, swerving around, I call it, just waiting and hoping.
It's the end of the day, and the fishermen are weighing their catch.
Hi,
oh, not bad.
How was your morning?
Oh, good.
Good. You're turning your boat around?
Yeah, well, I got to bring her in and offload.
Okay.
But that's it. We're done, like, for today.
While some aren't sure if they'll come back to fishing next year, and others have even put their boats up for sale, Carl Hedderson says he'll keep hoping for a lobster license, not only for him, but to pass on to his son and other future fish harvesters.
Life is not always about money, but you got to have it this day and age to survive. And there's lots of fish in the ocean here, things that we could, don't need, for fishermen all your life, they don't need to be this, like this, right? We should be having something, you know? So if we don't have lobster or something like that, that you know you can sell, you're done.
For The House, I'm Caroline Hillier on Newfoundland's Northern Peninsula.
So what does the government have to say about the concerns we just heard? Mike Kellaway is the parliamentary secretary to the Minister of Fisheries and Oceans. I met him at his office this week. Mike Kellaway, thank you very much for this conversation.
Great to be here.
There has been some real pushback to your government's lifting of the cod moratorium. The Fish, Food and Allied Workers Union says that that will undo the work that's been done to rebuild the stock. The provincial Liberal government says you're giving foreign fleets too much access. And some fish harvesters, like the ones we just heard from, feel nothing has changed for them. How do you explain your support for this?
Well, you know, and it was great to hear that piece, and it reminds me of back home in Cape Breton. Let me just say that the fishers that you heard and so many others in Newfoundland and Labrador, and when you put it in perspective over the last 32 years, the community fabric has taken a shot. The moratorium is not just about economics, although that's a huge part of it. It's culturally and historically significant. When you look at the decision that was made in terms of going from the critical zone to the cautious zone with respect to the stock, the plan that's put forward is around 84% of the quota going to inshore, 10% going to First Nations, Innu and Inuit, and 6% the offshore. And I think that's really important to put out there. A lot of times I don't hear that stat in conversations, even conversations that I'm a part of. I think it's a balanced approach. I think we need to communicate that more to folks to ensure that a lot of the vitriol that's out there doesn't permeate the communications agenda.
Vitriol is a very striking word, yeah. Mr. Kellaway. I mean, you think that the opposition to this is what, out of line?
No, not at all. I think politicians maybe, but when it comes to the actual people, no. People want to make a living, provide for their families, provide to community wealth. That's really, really, really important. The stakes are high. This is a good news story, in my opinion, but the rationale behind the decision, you know, if you look at the offshore decision to get 6%, The offshore, you know, is Canadian offshore. It's men and women that are on those boats and in those processing plants that are providing for their families in Newfoundland and Labrador, too.
But it's also international vessels.
But here's the thing, though. When you look at having our vessels, do you imagine a world where there's international, you know, vessels just outside the 200-mile limit and no Canadian vessels within the 200-mile limit? I think we would have another news story on that.
Help me understand that.
There's two categories of offshore vessels. Mm-hmm. There's the international, and then there's Canadian.
Yeah.
The offshore vessels will continue to fish. If we didn't have 6%, there'd be no offshore Canadian vessels there at all. So what we're trying to do is strike a really strong balance for Newfoundland and Labradorians. But I think that, you know, it's very tempting for some folks to actually add a little spit on the ball, as they say, in terms of that. And that's usually politicians. But for the average Newfoundland and Labradorian, this is absolutely at the core of who we are.
You talk about how this politicians, there's politics at play here. Yeah. Your fisheries department, the government's fisheries department, had a briefing note from earlier this year that said by lifting this moratorium, the government risks endangering the cod stocks. In that same note, we learned that political advisors in the minister's office believe hiking quotas would be, quote, politically a victory. That seems like pretty crass politics, Mr. Kellaway.
I think a victory for Nova Scotians, but Newfoundland and Labradorians is at the heart of this. And you do that by putting together a solid plan that are made of all stakeholders. I can rhyme them off. First and foremost, First Nations, the corporate sector, inshore, offshore, processors. It's about ensuring that we put the best foot forward. When it goes from the cautious, from the critical to the cautious, you have a decision whether to fish or not to fish, to be responsible or irresponsible. This 18,000 ton is a responsible approach to opening a fishery. And let's see, my hope is that we can grow it. But science will dictate that. Science will dictate, and conversations with fishers. Some of the men that you were listening to just now, those are the conversations that we have in joint management that will hopefully, you know, add color to what the next steps are down the road.
Well, there, I mean, you say we're being responsible and this is a victory. I think
victory for Newfoundland and Labrador.
Well, I mean, they're basically saying horse feathers, right? That this was just about raising a sign and going, hey, look, moratorium's over, even though they're not gaining any benefit from it.
I think that it depends on who you talk to. When you look at, you know, when we made the decision, NGOs said it was the wrong decision and that we shouldn't fish at all. Offshore seemed to be receptive to it. Folks in the inshore that have been interviewed certainly were opposed to it. But the decision of the minister is to come down for the best decision of the whole. And I think that this is a sound decision based on fairness. But that's why we have such a robust joint management team. And that's why we have such great partners, is that we hear about, you know, we receive feedback. And that goes into the mix for future decisions down the road.
The fishermen we heard from say that in order to make a living, they want to be able to catch lobster as well. Yeah. Why was that request for permits not granted?
Well, every 3 years, it's basically a team, a collaboration between DFO and industry. They review decisions on lobster. The last decision was in 2022, and the decision was to remain status quo. But that, they'll be meeting again.
Well, there were new exploratory licenses that were given to Quebec's Lower North Shore, as I understand
and it. That's an important piece. So let's unpack that. That quota, that is for scientific research. That's not for commercial sales. What that is designed to do, and it's a proactive approach to say, hey, let's do the science here with fishers to determine is there a viable lobster fishery there.
Still, these gentlemen that we heard from want a piece of that. What is your message to them?
Well, my message to them is, and I think it's an important part of the process, is to work with that group, that industry DFO group, to actually push towards a scientific review, a scientific actually fishery, to determine is there a viability here. And science is a huge part of this, but also don't underestimate the knowledge and the experience of fishers. And that's where that comes together. So yes, Quebec has a scientific fishery that is designed to determine, is there a possibility of a commercial fishery? It's not a commercial fishery. Can it happen in Newfoundland? Why not? Let's see if we can have those discussions at the next round to go down that road.
Okay, we're going to leave the conversation there. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Mike Kellaway is the Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Fisheries and Oceans. We also wanted to get the Conservatives' take on this issue. Rick Perkins is one of the Conservative MPs on the Fisheries Committee. I met him just outside the House of Commons. Rick Perkins, thank you for making the time.
Anytime.
These fishermen, the union, provincial politicians of all stripes have raised concerns with the Liberals about lifting the cod moratorium. Would conservatives move to reinstate it?
We would have left it at a stewardship fishery. We have been hearing for years that the cod are returning in larger numbers, a northern cod on the north side of Newfoundland. The government has not done the trawl surveys on the science. They let it go for about 3 or 4 years, and they finally did one last year and said, oh, look, there's more cod. So there are international agreements that Canada is a party to with the North Atlantic Fisheries Organization, and we have to abide by those. But they should have been renegotiated before any increase in the cod was offered by this government. But they were going for the quick political hit with the downtown Toronto coverage to say, hey, look, the cod are back. Aren't we wonderful? We've started it up again. And they didn't listen to the science, and they didn't do their negotiations.
Nonetheless, obviously, there is a lot of focus on this idea of lifting the moratorium. So if your point of view is work still needs to be done, would it be an ambition of a future Conservative government to lift that moratorium?
It certainly would, but we'd have to do it through negotiating in NAFO to ensure that the first 100,000 metric tons or more of cod that was available to be caught commercially would be caught by Canadian harvesters only, because a problem with what the government has done is the government has allowed the foreign fleets, the very same fleets that 32 years ago were the ones responsible for destroying the cod stocks, back in the waters because they put politics over a proper structure to get our fish harvesters access.
We heard from fish harvesters in Newfoundland who are hoping to diversify by getting lobster permits. How would a Conservative government address that request?
Well, lobster is a bit of a different challenge because lobster is the only fishery that doesn't operate under a quota. It's managed by the number of traps that are in the water and the period of time they're allowed to be in the water. And Newfoundland has a burgeoning, growing lobster fishery. One of the shortcomings of this Liberal government is they have zero science on the state of the lobster stocks. So to be able to increase lobster licenses, you need to do that based on science. DFO needs to start doing science on the Newfoundland lobster stocks so that they can pick the right level of licenses and traps to be issued.
My understanding from our conversation with Mike Kellaway is that some of the permits that they have in fact released to folks in Quebec are exploratory. That's about doing the science. So again, my question is, would folks in Newfoundland expect to have more access to lobster if the Conservatives were in power?
Well, we're talking about the lobster in Newfoundland, not any lobster in the Gulf of St. Lawrence in Quebec, and they haven't done anything around that science in Newfoundland.
Rick Perkins, thank you for your time.
Always a pleasure.
Nova Scotia Conservative MP, Rick Perkins. Before we go, a few weeks ago, we talked to MPs about the harassment they say they faced. This was after NDP leader Jagmeet Singh had a confrontation with some protesters on Parliament Hill. This week, we got an update. A secure perimeter has been established so the public no longer has access to the parliamentary precinct at certain locations when the House of Commons is sitting. And Ottawa police are creating a new Parliament District Detachment. A number of you wrote in about the harassment of politicians. Our senior producer, Jennifer Chevalier, is here with some of those emails. Jennifer, what did folks say?
Well, Frank McKinney in Toronto thought the behavior of the people who pushed Liberal MP Talib Nur Mohammed and called NDP MP Lori Idlout a Nazi was inexcusable. But he went on to say that those people are protesting because politicians are not hearing what they're saying. And Kathy Griffin in Burnaby, BC, wondered if protesters harassing politicians makes for what she called good TV for Pierre Poilievre. She says the Conservative leader's failure to call out the men who harassed Singh is evidence he's not ready to lead Canada. And Jonathan Matula in Red Deer County, Alberta, wrote, "Members of Parliament are the proverbial pot calling the unruly protesters' kettle black. MP's behavior during question period is atrocious. The yelling, catcalls, and overall disrespectful behavior is downright rude." He writes, "MPs need to control their own behavior before they can think of holding unruly protesters accountable." Finally, we had an email from a listener who works in education. She didn't want her name read out. But to Jonathan's point, she noted that teachers expect a lot from kids in terms of their behavior, talking to their peers respectfully, listening to others even when they disagree. But what she sees from MPs is, quote, "a large portion of adults struggling with their own self-regulation skills." She writes, "I wish more adults would take responsibility for their actions in a way that would model the best of who we should be to our young people."
Thank you very much for this, Jennifer.
You're welcome.
Okay, that is it for us this week. Our crew on the house is Kristen Everson, Emma Godmere, Benjamin Lopez-Steven, and our senior producer is Jennifer Chevalier. Technical production this week by Miguel Plante. I'm Catherine Cullen. Thank you so much for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.